Welcome to the Chasing Tomorrow podcast. Today, I have an exciting guest on the show, Matt Lyon, who's the CEO and founder of Hydropack, who's been in the outdoors business for the past 20 plus years, who started on this journey back in 2001. We'll talk about that in a second. I've gotten to know Matt over the past couple of months as we've just talked about growth strategies for both company and each of us individually. And so we have been pushing on that rope a little bit. And we're going to hear some more about the cool part of what does it take to start a business and keep it going. And we'll hear from Matt directly. Matt, how are you doing?
Very good. Happy to be here, Joe.
Yeah, I appreciate it. We'll do the founder story in a second, but just tell everyone a little bit about Hydropack because they may not know what the business is. Let's start there.
Sure. So Hydropack is a 22-year-old company. So we started in 2001. And what we're all about is performance hydration or hydration for athletes. And so currently, the way that you might most likely know us is through our original equipment partners. So we provide flexible reservoirs for backpacks and soft flask for running vests. And we do that for probably 80 different brands around the world. Our reservoir is best in the Osprey backpack line, as well as folks like North Face, Patagonia, you name it, lots of bike brands and outdoor brands. And in the running space, we basically developed these products jointly with Salomon when they first introduced the products. They're still our largest partner on that space. But we work with, again, we were just at the running event in Austin, Texas, and we had a slide of a dozen different brands that were carrying our products and their vests. So that's the way we're best known. But we also then directly sell our products in outdoor stores, on the internet, sporting goods stores, whatnot, which would both be biking, running, and hiking products.
Wow, that's a lot. I like that. We're going to get into some more detail on that. It strikes me, Matt, that I think today, there's a lot of awareness about hydration and dehydration and making sure you have enough fluids when you do some activities. But when you started this, was there that level of sensitivity to how much hydration was important?
Well, I mean, so hydration has always been critical, obviously. Our human needs for it haven't changed. And when I first got into it, the hydration backpack was a pretty new idea. So it was only a few years old at that time. And this idea that you could do more than just a bottle and have hydration be incorporated in different ways, whether it's on your bike or on your back or in your hands, that was really blossoming. And so I would say when we started, it was literally bottles. And then the one competitor that had started before us, which was Camelback. And kind of just the ideas were just sprouting up all over on how to do it. And I think as time will tell, there were a lot of bad ideas, right? There were a lot of ideas that didn't go anywhere, or people thought that they were going to have the next huge hit with some kind of crazy concoction. But like everything with water, it's the simpler is the better. You want to have it. You don't want to think about it. But certainly it started with water. I would say it's even taken a whole new level in the last 5 years as people have really started getting into the fuel, into the hydration and electrolyte aspect of it and the recovery aspect, just the awareness. I was even reading an article about the number of records that have been set in professional cycling this year. And it's just due to the amount of carbs that people are able to absorb during these long races that they do in cycling, which has been breakthroughs in nutrition. So the category just continues to unfold, if you will. And I love it because these are all just kind of natural things for our body and things that our bodies have been capable of doing. We're just kind of figuring out different ways of unlocking them.
Yeah. Wow. Let's get back to that in a second also. All right. So the founder story, you tell us, how did this whole thing start and what were those first years like?
Well, the first thing I tell my kids, I didn't plan on getting into hydration. That wasn't a lifelong goal or anything like that. But I did have the goal of getting in business. I grew up in a family that my father had started a small business when I was in elementary school. We didn't get allowances. We got to go work. And so it was very much a family philosophy. I have two siblings. They both also own their own businesses. So it's definitely something my father said he was a mountain climber and his kids didn't climb the mountain with him, but they found their own mountains to climb.
Nice.
And so kind of there is a family trait in there. I had been working out of college for a few years. I was in finance. It's what we call private equity now, although it wasn't called that at the time. But I landed it. I had worked mainly in industrial businesses. And so that's what my family business, what I knew. And I got a job in footwear, doing athletic footwear. And I just loved the category. It really related to what I did personally. I loved the kind of product cycle introductions of annual products. I love being able to kind of go to the factories, work with the manufacturing, go work with the consumers, get their feedback, kind of that bee buzzing between the flowers and kind of making it all happen. Went through grad school, started kind of pursuing that path working for other folks. My first job was doing high-tech snowshoes, manufacturing them in downtown San Francisco, back when that still was possibility. And then I went and ran a mountain bike company for 5 years and got kind of deep into the bicycling side of things. And after 5 years, I thought, okay, I'm ready to do this on my own nickel. And so I borrowed some money and I went to my father's advice was don't start just from scratch. Start with something that's already there. It'll save you some time. Because he always says the first 5 years are the worst. So this was summer 2001. If you remember, there was a little mini recession that summer. So we had gone through a lot of the dot-com pain and there was some slowdowns across the one of the local brands in the space decided to sell a few of their companies. The company was Bell Sports, which owned like Bell, Giro, Blackburn, at the time, different brands. They decided to sell the Road Gear trunk rack line and the HydroPack hydration pack line. And so I really liked the look of HydroPack. It's a category that needed some technical expertise and knowledge, which is sealing water and carrying water. But I thought also a young enough category that there was still an ability for someone with a product design background like mine to be able to develop products and patent them. And then I really liked the idea of being able to work in different categories. So I'd been worked just in bikes before, just in snowshoes, et cetera. And so I really wanted a product that could go across different activities. So I put in an offer. It's kind of a funny story. The company was selling they were selling, but the employees really liked the company. And so they didn't want to sell it to somebody that would shut the company down. The only two offers they had at that time, one was from me and one was from Camelback. And so they knew if they took the Camelback offer, they kind of came and told me that. And I ended up being able to lower my bid and still get the company. Because of who I was competing against is the short story. But yeah, so they accepted the offer on September 10th, 2001. So I was in an office building in San Francisco with my lawyer drafting up the documents on 9/11. And I was so excited, I didn't really care what was going on. And the lawyer didn't care, so we just put a TV on the table and kept on going. They evacuated the building, but we kept on working. So that's kind of how it started. So it was just me, a line of backpacks, a factory in China. I had lots of connections with salespeople and retailers and whatnot. So we got started pretty quickly. But as they say, what you don't know is what can kill you. We had a great first couple of years just doing hydration backpacks, expanding with retailers. Like, I couldn't believe how well it was going. I just thought wow, I really got this right. What I did not realize was the hot brand at the time was Camelback. They were so busy manufacturing reservoirs for the military in preparation for the invasion of Iraq that sort of Afghanistan, Iraq, the military already knew. They were going to the desert. They needed these systems. And so Camelback couldn't supply any of the retailers. And so we were getting all the orders because they couldn't supply the retailers. So the day after the invasion of Iraq, the military said, okay, thanks, we've got enough. And Camelback immediately turned all that production on the marketplace, flooded the market. They ended up flooding the market for 6 months, then selling the company. And so the hard part was for me, who had all those retailers who couldn't get enough of those products. And then when they were available, we lost something like 9 of our top 10 customers within a 2-month period. And so, yeah, that was the typical, I could tell you lots of stories, lots of ups and downs in the early days. But so we were going great, hired people. That happened, let a lot of people go. Kind of, as I say, that's when my ego as a businessman became about as kind of like the grass on a putting green. So learned my lessons and kind of looked at what customers stuck with us, which ones didn't, started thinking about the market a little differently and decided at that point that hey, maybe backpacks is not the easiest way to go. That's a very marketing driven, it's very capital intensive. And we had a customer that already had a strong lead, but I saw a lot of other players out there in the marketplace that wanted to get into the space, but they just didn't have the plumbing. right? They didn't really have a system that worked well for carrying the water, delivering the water. And these were much bigger brands. So bigger brands than us, bigger brands than Camelback. And these were the, again, like the Patagonias and North Faces of the world. And so decided that that was probably a better tact for us to take. And so we called that the original equipment business. And so we kind of redeveloped our products to be a little more universal instead of specifically for our own backpack. So they'd work in every backpack and started calling upon these larger customers with the idea of us being the hydration inside for their backpack lines. I think our first major client was Dakine in 2006 in all their mountain biking gear. And we grew pretty quickly from that point. It was a successful strategy. We had really figured out the things that people needed. Up to that, if you wanted to do a hydration pack, you had to buy the reservoir and there were long lead times. You had to buy it from Israel. You had to buy it from the US. You had to put an inventory of them somewhere, try to predict what you were going to sell for the next year. It was not a very easy business to get in. We knew the business because we had been doing backpacks. So we figured out how to get people's orders and ship them within 6 weeks so they could place the backpack orders at the same time as the reservoir orders, completely changed the kind of dynamics around the supply chain for people to get into it. And it really allowed a lot of companies that had wanted to add these products to product lines to be able to add them. And so this really fueled a lot of growth for us. To say when we, before we signed our first OE customer, we were making about 40,000 backpacks a year and selling them. It's not a bad number. Within probably 4 years, we were still doing about 40,000 backpacks a year, but we were shipping over 1 million reservoirs.
Oh, wow.
So we had really kind of discovered, if you will, our niche and how we could compete. And at that point, we did thought actually the reservoir or the backpacks were just distracting us. And so we, at that time, decided to drop the reservoirs. And then we started looking at other hydration, or sorry, drop the backpacks. We started looking at other hydration. So one of the first things we got into was soft flasks. It was developed actually as a handheld product for people just to carry for runners. Thankfully, the smart people at Salomon got a hold of it and started using it for all their professional athletes who loved it. Again, carrying it in their hand. You know, we were doing a very small quantity at that time, but they had the vision of being able to make a vest and put them in the pockets in the front.
Right, right.
And so we kind of developed that product together. That was just, they did all of the cut and sew, the vest, the garment, working with the professional athletes. We dialed in the size, the shape, whatnot, for the flasks. And it was basically started a whole new category. Again, kudos to Salomon and their marketing team for how well they were able to introduce that and the quality with which they made products, especially in the beginning, and really got that. And that was adopted by trail runners. And now you see it all over the place. It continues to increase in the adoption. So that was great. And then after that was also an original equipment product for us. And then after that, we started introducing our own products directly, things like water storage for backpackers, flexible bottles for skiers, and hikers. Now we're in things like squeeze bottles for bicyclists, filtration to go on with the water storage, all things like that. But yeah, so for the first few years, though, it was like kind of like that original equipment angle was when we really started cooking with fire.
This is probably not atypical of the cycles of a startup. You get your sort of minimum viable product out there, people buy it, your demand curve was affected by Camelback selling to the Army, but demand curves early can always be positive, right? Because we get early adopters or we hit a vein in the market. All right, so then all of a sudden it goes away, which seems to be typical also. So what kept you going at that point? Because of course the OE thing sounds like, oh, wow, yeah, we just fell into that. But from having a lot of business to sort of not much, it's hard, right? I mean, like, what? Why not just give up?
Well, the answer is surprisingly straightforward. So I borrowed the money from my father and I wasn't going to not pay him back. And so actually his accountant came in and told him, oh, you just need to write off this loan and let your son go do something else. This company's not going to make it. And that was not the outcome that I wanted to see. And so I think we went from like 7 employees to 2 employees. So it's not a lot of employees in total, but it's a big change from a percentage standpoint, let me tell you, and kind of the whole plans. But I had this idea for this other part of the business I thought would work, again, the original equipment. I just thought it needed some time. So I decided the way I kept it going was I actually had to go start a second business because I couldn't pay myself a salary. And I had three kids at home at that time, mortgage. I had done an SBA loan. So that was in the later days. So I had that as well. I kind of went back to my roots in finance. I knew I could put together something and it's not my favorite way to make money, but I knew I could do that. And so I put together a finance company with a couple guys and did that on the side, basically to keep HydroPack afloat when I wasn't able to take a salary. And I used that money to pay other people to keep going. So it was, and I will have to, I've got to give credit to my father, because I was pretty down in the dumps when that happened and wasn't really able to see very far in front of me as far as what the future was. And he basically came and visited me in my office and just gave me that talk like, hey, get up, keep going, do one thing today. This is old school style. He's like, just put one letter in the mail today. Like, figure out someone to write, put a stamp on it, mail it. He said, just do that every day. Kind of came in and pulled me out of the doldrums and got me kind of moving forward. Yeah, for me, it's a big thing when I was able to have enough money to pay back all those loans. So,
and did you consider, or wasn't possible to raise other money at that time?
Well, I suppose it was possible. I did not think I had much to sell. So I did not think anybody would give me, even if I would have sold it at that time, I don't think I could have gotten enough money to pay off the debt.
Right. So then, other than the money that your father gave you, you've sort of, as the saying goes, you've bootstrapped this from operating income to growth that you're at today.
Yeah, that really it's a little bit of money just to start, which was that really important to me. Took out an SBA loan, which was the second piece of debt. And then that was the last. Everything since then has been internally generated cash flow. So no other investors or fundraising, which is a very interesting discipline all on its own.
Right. Yeah. Like during this period of time, of course, okay, so you start growing again. This OE business is doing very well. It's nice to have, I guess, what we'll call real customers, but you're still sort of on the edge because you have to have that business to make enough profit so you can continue. As we know, revenue doesn't pay the bills, the profit does.
Yeah.
So how did you learn as you went along? What were you telling yourself? How did you figure it all out to keep this thing moving forward?
It's funny when you're small like that. Like, so I did not, I had a father who was a business owner, so I could turn to him for some advice. Although I figured out pretty quickly on to take his advice with a pretty heavy grain of salt, you know, it was specific to his time and his industry. One of the things that I learned early on, I kept on saying, like, the market is always teaching us lessons. And so, like, everything that would happen, every success, every failure, I'd see somebody else being successful or whatnot. And I really just studied those things and tried to say, okay, what is the market trying to tell us? And I think, I mean, it's one of the great things about owning a business and growing a business like that is that you do get feedback. If you're making a profit, that means people value what you're doing beyond what it costs you to provide it. And so there is your definition of value. I don't have to wait till the last day if I decide to sell the company to figure out it's worth something. I can find out every year if people are paying us enough to pay to make a profit. And if we're not making a profit doing it, that means people don't value my time for anything more than just kind of my hourly wages. And so I would look at that and especially other folks doing things that were smart or not smart as it would be, and try to kind of look at for those feedback mechanisms, and they get distorted. Some people hit the right product at the right time and things just take off.
Yep.
But if you stick around for a while, you see those things usually, you know, like a rocket go up and then come down.
Yeah.
And you're able to figure out what's kind of a fad versus what's kind of a long-term, smart, strategic-based growth. And so I definitely think that the market was a big source of learning. My leadership style is very supportive. So I've always had a team of people around me, and I've always tried to empower them to make decisions and thinking like, why have a dog and bark too? I'm going to bring people in, let them do things and make decisions. And so I've had quite a few employees over the years and was able to learn, I think, from just about everyone that came in. I mean, everybody's got some good idea, some angle, some insight. And after a while, you do start to accumulate those things.
Yeah. It's interesting. So just back on making sure everyone says, when you say of it, this original equipment business, you make a product that other vendors buy from you and they sell it under their brand. They may attribute it to you. So you have these big companies who you're serving, not just the consumer.
Correct.
They're giving you feedback. You're learning from them. But like one of the things I always found was that continuing to innovate is hard, right? Others come and nip at your heels and try and do better. And over the past five, like there were, we're talking one day, Matt, like Nalgene's been around forever as a hard plastic bottle, right? Bit of a niche. And then there was Camelback we always heard about. But then more and more bottle stuff has come out over the past 5 to 10 years here. And we're just like almost inundated with products. So as this happens around you, how have you continued to innovate? What's been your source of like thinking about how do I make my product better? Why would these OE guys continue to buy from me? Why do I own 90% of this market? Like, how's that been working?
Well, two things on that. First, there was a company that came out some stuff, maybe it was 10 or 15 years ago, and I saw that the, call it beverage container or bottle or whatnot market worldwide, several billion-dollar market, 50-some percent of that market was made up of players with less than 2% market share. There were a lot of folks like Nalgene that maybe only sold one bottle out there, but they really killed it with what they did. And so now I say Yeti, you think of a certain product. I say Stanley, you think of a certain product. Think of Hydro Flask, you think of a bottle. Like each one of these folks has their thing and will say, I'm number one at X. And so that was something that told me, okay, you can hold your own in this space. It's possible for a small company to do well in these areas. The innovation thing comes from two places. One, like I mentioned, I've got an engineering product development background. So I'm kind of a product guy at heart. And I say that if you're a product guy, the answer to every problem is a new product. And so it's like, so there was just kind of a natural inclination to always wanting to have new products to solve all the problems that we were fighting. The other thing you mentioned about OE business being tricky with that case. And when we were doing just backpacks before we decided to get in this, I saw several people attempt to do this business. And what they would do is they'd come in with the cheapest product they could make, kind of had one or two new features, be inexpensive. They would sign a 3-year contract with a manufacturer. And then they would figure out the price, you know, amortize their tooling and whatnot. And they would spend no money on innovation or design for those 3 years. Well, 2 years into it, their competitor had figured out how to come up with a better product, newer features, whatnot, pitched all those customers. And at the end of that contract, all the customers switched to a different supplier.
Yep.
And I saw that happen a couple times going back and forth to these different companies. And I just thought, well, that's a crazy approach to this. And it's a manufacturing-based approach. I'm going to take a contract, I'm going to fill up my factory, I'm going to run my factory. And I said, I want a market-based approach, not a manufacturing-based approach. So we had a factory that's manufacturing for us. I said, we're going to make our business out of knowing the market and satisfying the problems in the market. So first of all, we signed no contracts. So we entered into this business. Everyone else before was all about manufacturing contracts. We said, forget it. We'll just take your orders and fill them. And you have no commitments. You can switch anytime. Well, that made us drive innovation because the customers could leave at any time. So we had to keep coming up with new products to keep them interested and entertained and to keep the other competitors at bay. So we kind of embraced this market competition rather than going for a manufacturing kind of fixed cost model, saying, okay, this is sustainable. Like to compete every year is really what everyone has to do. So this would be a model that's sustainable. And it ended up working. Yeah, so it worked very well. And for those other folks that were around trying to do this at the time, again, they weren't used to innovation. They didn't have the muscles built up to do it. And so we were innovating every year. And a lot of them just kind of fell by the wayside because suddenly the basis for competition was not price or capacity. It was innovation. It was story. It was customer relevance.
Yeah. It's interesting because all the business books would write very different approaches to this whole topic of growth, like by cost or price or product innovation or other. So it's great to hear your approach. The time I spent with you was fun to hear how you describe some of the features of things that as a user of the product you like, but you didn't actually know why you liked it so much. You know? But it just worked better. And with hydration, it's actually, right, it seems like a really simple problem, but the last thing you want is your stuff leaking, hard to use, off-putting taste, hard to fill, all these things that are very practical, they should just work, right?
Like, yeah, because glasses have been around forever, right? You know how to use a glass. Like, nobody has to show you that.
Right.
Why should you have to think about it? So it is true.
And then one of the things you've done, right, you have, it's probably these are always very sensitive topic. You've had to do some manufacturing outside the U.S., manufacturing in the U.S., had to think about all the complexities there. How did you work through that? Like, what was your guiding principles?
Again, the first thing was I really am into manufacturing. So my thesis in grad school was on design for manufacturability. So I really believe in understanding the manufacturing process, the capabilities. Some innovations come strictly from the marketplace, like user needs change. Some innovations come straight from the factories, like new capabilities, new materials that allow you to do things. And that you really want to keep an eye on both. So I wanted to be market focused as a company. So we decided not to own any machines. That was kind of enough. But we wanted to find manufacturers that we could partner with that would be transparent about the information of what's happening as far as technology and developments. And so it took us a few years to get there, but we were working with a manufacturer in China. We got them to kind of open up in this way and kind of change their systems and how they approached it and how they held inventory and whatnot to accommodate this approach. And it was all me going there and saying, we'll take care of the customers. We'll deliver you the orders. You just worry about filling the orders. And when we started, we were so small. At one point, they decided they had too many customers. They came and visited me to tell me they were going to drop us as a product. And I had to sit down over dinner and convince them to continue to manufacture the products and to give us a little more time. And we're now that factory's largest customer. So, oh, wow. And yeah, the guy who I had that dinner with still owns the company. So we still chuckle about those things. But so I have tried many times to embrace U.S. manufacturing because there's different angles on that. The thought that maybe higher quality, maybe faster, shorter supply chain, which was a big item for the last couple of years, and have really had a tough time of making it work. Because in our category, there's, well, first of all, for the original equipment business, all of those products, the cut and sew products, the backpacks, the vests, they're made in Southeast Asia. So if we made things in the US or in Europe, we'd have to ship them all to Asia, which was a problem before. So by making them in Southeast Asia, we have one day shipping. So it's kind of another part of the supply chain piece that we figured out, which says to me that we'll always need to have manufacturing close to where they're making backpacks and vests, just Southeast Asia. The other side, things like bike bottles, we've done a couple different tries at US-based manufacturing. And in that particular product market, there wasn't enough differentiation or enough consumer preference for there to be any sort of a premium at all for made in USA. Absolutely zero. Including one other competitor who says they're made in the USA, but they actually make half their stuff in Taiwan. They just don't really talk about it. So like this, like, but people don't dive in too far into it. And so it's when you do a fully US supply chain, just the high cost of tooling, the slow response time of the manufacturing, because they're mostly set up for high volume, lower price items. For what we do, if you think of a bike bottle, it's made on the same machines that you would make your 1 gallon bottle for milk, right? So it's the same kind of blow mold materials, machines, whatnot. And so somebody would much rather make 1 million orange juice jugs a month rather than 50,000 bike bottles.
Right.
And they're not set up for, you know, hey, we've got new gravel bottles and we're looking for a new size and a little different kind of cap because now I got people doing something new. They're like, man, they haven't changed orange juice 20 years, I'm making more money on the orange juice bottles. Yeah. So it's so part of that is kind of getting past the where it's made and just finding the kind of people who are looking to be the kind of business partners that you need. And that's what I've found to be more important. I have been able to find those partners mostly in Southeast Asia, but we actually have one product line that the best guys I could find are in Enid, Oklahoma.
Okay.
And they got a factory there. There's not too much else there. Not easy to get to, but they're flexible guys. They like building small things. They're willing to invest in production capabilities, willing to work with us on shipping and everything else. And yeah, we actually bought a product line. It was about $150,000 when we bought it. We kind of sat down with this guy, said we're going to do it, and grew it into almost a $2 million product line. and they're the exclusive manufacturer for it. So they are very happy with the growth, and they've been a great supplier for us. And so in that, that's an example where we're not looking anywhere else for that. We're trying to make products in Oklahoma and ship them around the world. So it's all about finding the supplier with the right approach. And again, for me, I've never wanted to own a machine. I've always wanted to focus on the market and customer solutions and let someone else be the efficiency expert that figures out how to manufacture the product at a low cost and consistent quality and correct timing.
Yeah, and that's cool. You've been at it 20 years. How do you stay motivated? Like, why you haven't lost your mojo? You are still driving to build a business, innovating. I saw some new products that you were coming out with. Like, what is it that like that keeps you going?
So when I started, I thought I was going to do this for 5 years. My business plan had years 1 through 5 and nothing past year 5, right? So it wasn't like I had a long-term vision when I started. Of course, when I got to year 5, like I said, things weren't so great. So suddenly it was about making decisions 1 year at a time or a couple of years at a time instead of a big, long plan. And so for me, it was always, well, am I better off doing this or am I better off doing something else? And so for the first, whatever it is, 5, 10 years, okay, had this challenge in front of me, figured it out, got it to a certain point. And it was at that point, I remember, so I went to business school. One of the presidents of the business school had this famous quote that everybody should have a new job every 10 years. Like everyone should have a new set of challenges, new experiences, apply themselves to a new job every 10 years. If you're in a place where you can't get a new job, i.e. you own a company, then you need to reinvent your job. You need to figure out how to bring yourself a new set of challenges. And so for the first 10 years, I was a product designer and developer very much, kind of working with the factories and the athletes and coming up with the products. Then, so I said, okay, now I need to figure out how to put together a company and how we can get to the next level with this. So I tried to change what I was doing. And I did the same thing. And I got, it was 2020, like 2019, 2020. And I was saying, okay, we've had a good run at this and been able to double the size of the company, whatnot. What am I going to do differently? And so for me, the next thing was, okay, I want to bring in people from outside to talk to. And I want to learn from talking to other folks and bringing other people to come in and look at the business and get their advice. And I want to become more of a CEO as opposed to a president, which is really have delegated as much responsibility as possible and try to be more of a leader. So for me, like that kind of reinvention has been important, having new challenges and feeling like it's different from what happened before. Because I felt, boy, if I'm not someone that could come in and do the same thing every day. It's been at the same company, but it hasn't been the same thing. And then I'll also say you hit a certain point in life where I've spent enough time doing this and learning this business and the ins and outs and whatnot, that I think it's much more rewarding to apply what I'm doing within this space and this business and with my connections than it would be to go start fresh doing something completely new. I really kind of, at this point, I'm very happy to continue to just try to drive things. And even, I mean, you and I talked about this, but like one of our challenges right now, which wasn't a part of the business in the beginning, was about sustainability. And can we take what we've been doing and how we started doing it, and can we bring in this new element? And so now we're kind of using our position and our reach to move runs towards not using disposable cups during the run. So we call it cupless racing. And so trying to figure out how to work with events to get exciting, like for me, like an exciting thing we're doing now on these sustainability front, that one thing is trying to work with race directors to figure out how to get rid of single-use cups at events, which is, again, the statistic we found out, the New York Marathon in one day goes through 2.4 million cups. It's like, we're all just running for enjoyment or fun or whatever. It's like, do we really have to throw that much crap away? And so, and yes, when people carry something that's not single use, they use something like our product. So it's somewhat self-interested. But to me, this is a great thing to be able to talk about and then or to work on as a problem. And the second thing we're doing is we make squeeze bottles, bike bottles. We're trying to figure out how to take 10% of what we make, just as a starting number, and keep it out of landfill. Because like I said, if you want to buy carbon offsets and be a carbon neutral company, that's great if you're a law firm or something. But we're a manufacturer. Heck, we make this stuff. Even worse, we make stuff out of plastic. because it really works for our customers. Like, it really is a good material for our customers. So, like, how do we take and make it so people can feel good about buying these really high performance products and not feel like they're, you know, contributing to the Texas size floating mass of plastic on the Pacific? And so we're
right.
And so we went out and started talking to folks who use plastic like this and found out there's this whole thing they call reverse logistics. Like, these people have things they can make out of the plastic, but how do they get it? And even like your standard curbside recyclo, like, we make low density polyethylene, LDPE, which is the same thing, again, milk jugs are made out of. Most recyclers do not recycle that material because there's not a big enough market for the end product. So even though you put every milk jug in that recycling bin, it goes into landfill. And so we were able to find somebody that used these LDPE to make building materials. And they said, if you can get us the bottles, we'll use it. And so now we are, for 2020, we are setting up collection bins in front of retailers and at events. And we're using social media to tell people to bring their old bottles and bring them in. And then we're just taking part of our budget, like, let's say maybe part of our budget where I'd be using to buy carbon offsets, but instead we're paying to ship all these bottles back to this manufacturer to where they're going to convert them into new building materials. And so our goal is to get that up to 10%. Now, it's a pure cost for us, right? We don't get paid for the materials, but we think it's something our customers would like to see us do. And we think it's kind of the responsible thing as a manufacturer to start figuring this out. And if we're successful in the long run, there will be enough demand there that somebody will figure out how to make a business out of it and make money on it the way they do with the PET or the single use water bottles, that there is a big enough business that those get recycled. But so it's like, these are challenges that I did not deal with in the first 20 years. And these are concepts that we didn't. And now that we're a little bigger and now that we've got more reach, we can go start trying to tackle some of these things. And so for me, this is the kind of excitement that makes me feel like 22 years in, I'm really enjoying it still. And it's the same company, but I'm really doing different things every day than I used to do.
That's fun. I love that. And excuse me, as we've talked about the next 5 years and product and this sort of evolution of you and thinking about that, one of the things that we've been talking about is going out and doing some more adventuring to sort of like take some of what you've been building for everyone else to get out. I know you're a cyclist, but it's like, okay, can we do the big challenge? And because what you've found in the business, right, is you put a challenge in front of you and your behavior changes, right? And you start to think differently. And now we're going to go off and do a big, long bike race together. So tell me a little bit about how is that evolving in your thinking and getting ready for this and this new other kind of challenge.
Yeah, so to let everybody know, so Joe came and talked at our company, talked to the whole staff and talked about his story and book and kind of background and this idea of pushing yourself, of coming up with goals, getting out of your comfort zone. And very motivational. We had dinner afterwards and Joe kind of put the challenge out to me. Hey, why don't we do something that's beyond your comfort zone? And I got to tell you, I listen to your podcast and I hear all these people and I was the champion of this and the champion of that. I have never been the champion of anything. Okay. I love to be active and I love to compete, but I don't normally win. Right. So that I just love the competition. And so it tends to be more humbler activities, if you will. I'm happy to do a century bike ride a year. And so I was thinking about it. I'm like, okay, I'm not really a runner. Had a herniated disc a couple of years ago. I've tried to kind of keep light on the running since then. So I was trying to think of something that was out there from a cycling standpoint. I thought about this. We do sponsor a ride in Kansas every year called the Unbound Gravel Ride. And it's supposed to be amazing. 200 miles, Kansas roads, undulating kind of the hills of canvas. Last year it rained. People are coming. They say bring a paint stick to get the mud off your bike in the middle of the race. And they have limited amount of support. So you can't have someone supporting you during the ride, except at two stations in 2 miles. So if you have mechanical, you've got to bring everything, your clothing, lights for the nighttime, because we were talking about it, could take 20 hours to do 100 miles out there. And so we said, okay, let's do this. We agreed to it. I love it. Hydropack's been the sponsor of that event for the last couple of years, and it's really intrigued me. And so now very cool to actually go do it or to think about doing it. But as soon as we committed to it, like my thinking started changing. It was like, okay, I don't want to just do it. I want to do it properly. You know, I'd like to enjoy the ride, let's say.
Yeah.
Not suffer through it. I mean, there's going to be suffering, but I want to train well enough to try to enjoy the ride. And so I started thinking, literally mentally going through, what is it going to take to ride 200 miles? What do I need for equipment? What do I need for preparation? What do I need for nutrition? Like I said, I started listening to some of your podcasts because I'm like, oh, you talk to endurance people on it. So I started listening to some of those things about people and why they do what they do. And so it really got my mind into a different place about what it would take to accomplish something like this. And then I sat down and put a calendar and figured out, okay, we got 26 Saturdays between now and the event. So what do I have to do every Saturday to get ready? And then I was looking like, what rides could I do? Local sentries and other things, those training rides. And of course, I got the number of those Saturdays. I'm in China on business or something else. So it's not like every Saturday is going to be productive. So maybe I can only train on 18 of those 26 Saturdays. So I got to make the progress during those 18 weeks. So, and then I started thinking, I got a partner now. And so I did my first ride and I emailed you afterwards.
Yep.
I said, we're going to make this a joint thing.
Yeah.
And I would love to kind of take advantage of, I have a number of connections of people that make equipment, people in the nutrition world. It'd be great to be able to ask favors of people. I mean, Benjamin Franklin, you want to make friends? Ask favors. And so I'd love to ask these people for their latest and greatest and let me try it out. And get one from my friend Joe and we're going to talk about it together. And so kind of, as you said, like instead of just being a supplier or an observer of the market, truly being a participant. And so that's really exciting. I'm fired up for it. And I think that it'd be even great for, again, like their social media team to get involved and help talk about some of our, just as a company, like to be able to loop in some of our customers and whatnot. And ultimately though, I'm kind of looking forward to the idea of just getting to know a lot of people better from a personal involvement standpoint, rather than just kind of doing it as a business standpoint. And that it's not just a salesperson or a marketing person that's going to go deal with this. It's going to be me looking for something that's a solution for my needs. So I need to personally get involved and get out there and get to know people and whatnot. So I'm very fired up about it.
And when you and I talked about it, and I find this is like the magic of life. I always try and tell people, you got your lottery ticket when you were born. You just have to decide whether you're going to cash it. And what that means is that you get to sort of choose what you want to do. And sometimes we think that there's something in the way, but the minute you really do choose, whether it was to start Hydropack, what the heck did you know then other than, oh, I like this idea, and how to work through some of the times of issues. Matt decided how to do that. And then in this moment, and every time we do this, step into something, right? It gives us the opportunity to feel different, change our behavior, like live this life, right? Bigger and deeper. And like, yeah, we're not out there to win this. We're out there to experience life between now and then. I think it's funny that 26 weeks just seems like, oh my God, that's pretty soon already. And I'm still trying to finish up my running this year, but I'm like, oh, Matt, it's going to be 60 degrees in the East Coast this weekend, so I'm going to get out for a bike ride and a run and just start. Had we not signed up for it, I wouldn't have done that. And so I just love that it's just what we instigate in our life is what we become. And so if you want to become something, just go do it.
I told you, I heard a quote on your podcast. One of your guests said that she said the best version of herself is when she is training for an event. And she just likes that version of herself better than any other version. And that really stuck with me. And I was like, that is a great thought. Like, and it's not doing the event or whatever, or what time she did in it. It's just like the time period of preparing and building up and everything you go through. And I really related to that comment. And I'm looking forward to living it.
Well, you know what we can do? We'll certainly, for sure, we'll do a recap after the race.
Yeah.
Somewhere along in the middle, we might do a 15-minute check-in with our listeners to tell them how we're doing. They'll come along on the journey. Yeah, I think we have a lot of fun ahead. And so, Matt, I appreciate you telling your story. There were lots of good tidbits in there for everyone listening, especially starting a business. We love the connection with the outside and how you've enabled millions of people to hydrate properly along the way. And now we get to chase tomorrow together.
Excellent. Love it.
Thanks very much, Matt.
Thank you very much for having me on. I appreciate the opportunity. And yeah, looking forward to sharing the next 6 months at a minimum.